Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Omaha Town Hall Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Timothy Egan, winner of the National Reporting Pulitzer Prize for his work on the series How Race is Lived in America for the New York Times, where he is the Pacific Northwest correspondent, and author of 7 books, including The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America, The Worst Hard Times, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl, for which he won the National Book Award, and his latest book, Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, a biography of iconic photographer and nature advocate Edward Curtis. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday morning, October 22, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Town Hall, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Betsy Strain, president of the Omaha Town Hall Board of Directors.
Timothy Egan is an author, columnist, reporter, and has won two most prestigious awards a writer can win in the United States, the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. Formerly a national correspondent, he is now a very popular contributing op-ed columnist for the New York Times. Mr. Egan's book often concerned the intersection of geography, people, and the forces of nature. The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl, has been described as the story of our nation's greatest environmental disaster. It won the National Book Award and was the basis for Ken Burns' PBS documentary, The Dust Bowl. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Timothy Egan.
Well, thank you, Betsy. Thank you, Pastor. And thank you, everyone here in Nebraska, in welcoming me to an absolutely gorgeous Nebraska fall day. I want to, I'm going back to my home in Seattle, and we get a little rain, you may have heard. I'm going to take this day and yesterday, too, where I had a run with the colors, and just put it in one of my memory capsules. And on my bleakest, darkest January Seattle day, when I don't see the sun and the light disappears about 3:30. I'm going to pull it out and think of this day. So thank you for that. Also, it's a huge honor to be a part of the 50th anniversary. Was Billie Jean King here as part of the 50th as well? My God, I'm not worthy. That's really incredible. Thank you so much. I spent a lot of time in Nebraska trying to pull this story out of the minds and hearts of most of people who mostly aren't with us anymore. But it was not in this part of Nebraska. It was in the far western part, the Sandhills country, and the counties that have, you know, pretty much had a lot of towns that have left the map now, places that are depopulated, places that folks don't think about much anymore. I did benefit hugely from the Museum of the Germans from Russia, and I knew almost nothing. I'd like to think I knew a little bit about everything in American history. I knew almost nothing about that fascinating ethnic group, their journey here, how they went from Germany to the Russian steppe, how they came from the Russian steppe and just dropped their towns on the American Midwest, on the plains, and their sausage making, their beer making, their singing, and their customs and cultures, and then just getting hammered by this horrible disaster not long after they'd settled here and remade much of the Midwest. So thank you to that. I spent a lot of time in Lincoln for that. Now, I'm in this beautiful church, and I feel, even as an Irish Catholic, I should probably start a sermon here or sing, but I'll give you fair warning. I'm not going to sing or give you a sermon, but I do want to tell a story in the form of a parable, and that's how it came to me. I'm not an academic historian. I don't have a doctorate. I don't spend endless hours debating with fellow academics these really minute points that 4 other academics care about. Sorry, there was a dig. I'm a storyteller. I'm in search of stories in our history, our shared history, our stories that don't get told. And I was wandering the most unpopulated part of America for an assignment for the New York Times. It was the decline of small-town America. You know, 3/4 of all the counties in the western plains have less people now than they had a century ago. And then the census classified counties that had three people or less per square mile as frontier. And a majority of those counties are frontier now. So I was going through, you know, same kind of sad story one after the other. And then I started to hear mostly elderly folks in their upper 80s and 90s. They would say, I would close my notebook and they would say, but that's not the story of this place. And I would say, what is the story? And this person would go to a back and come back with a shoebox, open up the shoebox. And inside that shoebox was magic, pictures, diaries, letters, mementos from this extraordinary time in our history, a time that was almost forgotten. You know, Abraham Lincoln said, we cannot forget history. But we did almost forget this history. I mentioned last night at the dinner I was at in Lincoln that when I was researching this book, my kid was taking AP American History junior year in high school, and I opened up the standard AP American History book, 700 pages, and there's one paragraph on the Dust Bowl. And that bothered me, and that was one of the things that spurred me on to tell this extraordinary story. Now, we know a little bit about this, or we know a lot about it in our popular culture because of John Steinbeck. He wrote this book, The Grapes of Wrath. But Steinbeck only told one part of the story, and that's how so many things in our history happen. Somebody gets a take, a first take, and it's a good first take, and that becomes the accepted narrative. In Steinbeck's case, those were the people who left. Those were the exodusters. Those were the so-called Okies who fled to California and then were mistreated. A million of them left. A million of them left. It was the largest movement of Americans in our history to that date for a natural disaster. Nothing similar happened until Hurricane Katrina came along. But in fact, this is the second point. The Dust Bowl was not a natural disaster. It was a man-caused disaster. Every historian, every climate scientist, virtually everyone who's looked at this agrees it was a human-caused disaster. So the first thing I realized was that, you know, Steinbeck didn't necessarily get the story wrong, but he only told part of the story. That what happened to the 2 million people of the 3 million total who didn't go anywhere? What happened to the folks who stayed behind? What happened to those people who had a piece of prairie dirt and they were not going to give it up? What happened to those people who had never had anything in the life history of their bloodline, going back to Scotland, going back to Ireland, going back to Germany, going back to Russia, going back to Southern Europe, had something and they weren't going to give it up? That was my jumping off point. So I drove around in the research part of this for the better part of 2 years in what most Americans call flyover country. You know, it's the great empty. You look down, you go, God, does anyone live there? And we called it that before we had airplanes to fly over it. It just had different terms. When in the 19th century, when the great movement from the west to the east to the west, they called it the Great American Desert. That's what it was called on the map. And then, more specifically, the Oklahoma Panhandle, its formal name for about half a century was No Man's Land. That's partially because it fell between the free and slave divide. It's partially because it was a lawless country. You see how strangely that panhandle was drawn. They drew it in there and they didn't draw it properly. That was called No Man's Land. It was called the Great American Desert. And then the Spanish, who came up from the south, had a word for this southern plains. They called it the Llano Estacado, the staked plains. Another fascinating name. Why did they call it that? Because it was an infinity of flat. And they were afraid they would lose themselves in their journey through this area, so they put a stake in the plains every X amount of miles to find their way. And so these staked plains became, to the Spanish, the Llano Estacado. So how did I see this as a parable? Again, I got this construct from these amazing people I was so lucky to share, in some cases, the last days of their lives. People who, almost all of them have left the planet right now, but were around 7 years ago when I started my research, when I was in the midst of my research. these people whose eyes I would look into and see, like that scene in Titanic, you know, the opening scene of the movie Titanic. It's a very elderly woman, and she's suddenly she becomes a really hot Kate Winslet. Well, that's, you know, sort of like that for me a little bit. I would be talking to someone in their 90s, and after a while I would see a 17-year-old. And I would listen to this story about moving to the prairie and seeing it for the first time. And so that's what got me to sort of see this as a parable. Now, when we finally settled this part of the grassland, it was rhapsodized. Walt Whitman called it that delicate miracle, the ever-recurring grass. It was waist-high blue stem. It was short, resilient buffalo grass. And again, it was the last part to be settled. We settled the other parts of the prairie, but we didn't settle that great American desert part. The wind blew as it always does, as you know. The sun beat down 107 degrees in the summer, and then it could get to be 30 below in the winter. They had tornadoes. They had hail the size of baseballs. They had a few dust storms. They had grass fires. As somebody told me, five of the six things that could come from the sky could kill you. As an indication of how the weather was, which wasn't a really good advertisement for settlement. Now, because there was grass, there were bison, the great ungulates. All they needed was grass. So there were 60 million bison in this great grassland, the second biggest ecosystem in North America. And because there were bison, there were people, Indians, who lived off the bison, the Apache, Comanche, the Kiowa. In fact, the Comanche, an amazing tribe, 12 bands, they had a sign language they developed so they could speak with all the wind. One Comanche would look at another on a horse a half a mile away, and they developed an elaborate sign language so as a way to communicate through the wind. They lived sustainable lives. I wouldn't say they lived well, but they lived sustainable lives, a mobile community dependent on bison. But by the start of the 20th century, all the Indians had been moved aside. The treaties had been broken. It's an old story. They were moved to reservations, mostly in Oklahoma, which is the designated Indian territory. And the bison were gone. What had been a herd of 60 million people was diminished to about 400 individual bison who lived in Yellowstone National Park. That was it from the 60 million. So you had this huge swath of land on the map that was blank. And they called it a tabula rasa, a blank spot. What do we do? What do we do with this place? So what they did was they doubled the Homestead Act. Now, one of the myths of settlement is that homesteading happened mainly in the 19th century. That's not true. The majority of land was settled in the 20th century after they doubled the act. So between 1900 and 1920, you had the largest homestead surge in American history. Lincoln had signed the Homestead Act in 1862, and one of these great acts of Congress that happened in 1862, after the Confederacy was no longer part of the Union, they passed all these bills. And one of them was the Homestead Act. But then they enlarged it in 1900. So suddenly, you had a surge of people to this tabula rasa. And the railroads would go all over Europe trailing advertisements to try to lure people to come out here to the Great Plains. And these aforementioned Germans from Russia, they had gone to Russia 160 years earlier on Catherine the Great's admonition that they would never be taxed and never be drafted. And then the Tsars started taxing them and started drafting them. And about 160 to 200 million of them picked up and moved here. And they got in on this great Homestead Act, this doubling to a full square mile. And you had the so-called poor white trash, which were mostly Scots-Irish from the South. Their fathers had been the cannon fodder of the Confederacy. They weren't the slave owners. They were the grunts, and they had nothing. And they came to this part of the plains because they could have something. And you had some Latinos from the South who came up and settled as well. So you had all these people, I called them the last chancers. They'd never owned anything in the family's history, and they came up here. And so they said, what do we do with this land? They probably should have just grazed cattle, which would have been perfect. And the cowboys who were around at the time who fought with the people who wanted to grow something knew that it was perfect land for grazing. If it was perfect for bison, it would have been perfect for cattle. But they planted wheat. what was called dryland wheat. And the interesting thing about these Germans from Russia, they brought the one species that thrives in the arid plains. It's called Turkey Red. They also brought, by accident, what we know as tumbleweed, which is Russian thistle. Some people call it an invasive species. Some people think it's indigenous to the United States. In fact, it came from Russia. And they didn't bring it in accidentally. They didn't bring it deliberately. They brought it in accidentally. And for a while, the parable was all good. It was fantastic. These people who had nothing built sod houses. Now, I, you know, used to read Little House on the Prairie books when I was a kid, and I thought these sod houses were a construct of some, you know, graphic artist living in a quaint town in New England. But in fact, they were real. I saw them. You can still see some standing sod houses. One of the people I profiled was a woman who taught in a one-room schoolhouse that was built of grass, like an igloo would be built of ice. It was built of stacked grass. Now, when you talk to people who lived in a sod house, you ask them what they remember the dirt being turned upside down, and spiders, occasional snakes. The other thing, when they graduated from sod houses, they went to dugouts. And you can still see a lot of dugouts in the Western Prairie. Those are half underground, about 4 feet underground. The other half is above, always facing the opposite direction of the prevailing winds. When you ask people about dugouts, they remember, they say, well, that's where I learned about different baseball teams in the East, or that's where I learned about what was going on in the European War. You go, what do you mean? They go, because all the insulation was newspapers pasted on the wall. They were basically literally paper thin. So, but they came, they rose from their sod houses, they rose to their dugouts, and by 1920, many of them had really nice timber-framed homes with porches, and they had a Model T out front, and they'd get a piano so their kids could play. They did really well. This great miracle of what to do with this land was happening. And I wondered, as someone who comes from a well-watered part of the country, how the heck could you grow anything in this place without rivers? Well, I quickly learned from old-timers that what would happen was you'd order up a windmill kit from Sears and Roebuck, and then you would go down to the train depot, nearest train depot, and the trains were everywhere. That's, they encouraged the settlement. Pick up your windmill kit, take it out to your 1 square mile. The wind was always blowing, and it would be enough to pop up, suck up water. The aquifer was fairly shallow, and voila, you had the water of life. You could have a little garden. You could make things happen. You could have your slop for your pigs and have a vegetable garden. So they got their windmill kits, and they settled on their square mile, and they did well, and the price of wheat went from 30 cents a bushel to a buck a bushel, and then World War I came along, and Russia couldn't export. We became an exporter of wheat, and it got all the way up to $4 a bushel, which those of you in the ag world know, that's not far from what it's at right now. And there was a woman, Kansas wheat farmer, who famously said, I made more money than Babe Ruth did last year. So they were doing well. Now, as you know, in the parable world, or even in the world of economic bubbles, everything that goes up has to come down. And so the price of wheat popped because World War II was over, World War I was over, Russians went back to dumping wheat on the world market. We suddenly had no place for our export market. We had overproduced. So it went from $4 to $3 to $1 to 10 cents a bushel. And in fact, at one point, they were giving it away. So you see these pictures of these silos, along grain silos along the train stations, stuffed with grain, and there's nowhere to take it. There's no market for it. They put signs up in New York City that said, eat more bread, to try to encourage demand for this wheat. So that was the economic side of it, was that what went up came down. Your wonderful overnight expansion in this American dream crashed. And what did people do? Well, they do what we always do in a situation like that. You had to cover your nut. People had taken out bank loans for the first time. Every small town had a bank. And this is crucial to understand this. They took out loans. They went from their square mile, their little Jeffersonian plot, to 20,000 acres. And tractors came along, which changed the technical side of it so that the work of a dozen men could be done by one man. with an expanded new tractor, and they went out and they plowed more land because they thought, well, even though the price is terrible, we've got to get enough to cover our bank loan, so we just have to produce more. And that was called the Great Plow Up. And it happened after the price had collapsed. They just went out and plowed up more grassland and dug more ground and in order to get the price, in order to cover their net. So 1929 happens. Stock market in October crashes. October, always the scariest month for the stock market. And it wasn't catastrophic. I think the total was about 35%, which is, you know, a third of your earnings. But only 3% of Americans owned any stock in 1929. So why should this cause what became the greatest economic disaster of our time? If you lived out here in western Nebraska, you said, forget those swells in New York City jumping out of buildings. I don't own any stock. But here's what happened. Your money was in that bank. Every town had a bank. Those banks were unregulated. There was no FDIC. There was no, you know, separation of stock money with investor money. And those banks had taken your hard-earned cash and put it in the stock market. So when the market crashed, the banks collapsed. And one after another, snap, 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 you had 5,000 banks across the plains just shutter their doors. And there's a scene I have in the book from Dalhart, Texas, where people show up and they bang on the door and there's these planks in the window and they just, the thing's just been closed and the bank managers have fled and their money is gone. So you got killed by that. You may not have owned any stock, but your savings were in that bank and that was gone. So this economic collapse happens and it becomes our worst depression. One in four people are out of work. There is no Social Security. Remember, that comes in 1935. And at the same time that everyone is getting hammered, especially farmers, because the farm depression actually kicked in before the rest of the depression, people are really getting hammered. The land starts to blow. This thing that had been your great investment, your thing that changed your line, starts to turn on you. And it was small at first. They didn't know what to make of it. There would be a duster that it would appear, and you know, a couple fields would take to the sky, and they didn't quite know what to make of it. Now, I should mention there was one other element here. There were a group of speculators called suitcase farmers. That's what the term was for them. And they would show up at the train depot with their suitcase and claim their square mile or more, plow it up, throw some seed in the ground, and come back in the spring and hope to harvest their turkey red wheat and make a killing in it, as that woman who made more than Babe Ruth did. But when the market collapsed, those suitcase farmers let their land just go. So there was a big part of this speculative binge that left this land just barren. So things started to happen, and they didn't know what it was, because one of the things about our history, it's true now maybe of climate change, it's true of so many things, you never know you're in the middle of something when you're in the middle of something. You don't know how, you know, this will only last 10 years or this will last 2 years. They were called tomorrow people. They believed in one thing, which was that tomorrow would be better. And so they thought, this thing can't last. The land's starting to blow. What? Okay, so we're getting winds. We're in a bit of a drought. This can't possibly last. Well, they were seeing just the start of it. And after a while, they developed all these terms for these dust storms. They called, when snow was mixed with dust, they called it a snuster. And more typically, they called it a black blizzard. And it was impossible for me, as someone who comes from a green land, to try to understand a black blizzard until I saw some of the documentary films. And here's the way I would describe it. Imagine, you know, when you're driving toward Denver, closer you get to Denver, you see the Rocky Mountains, the whole range of the Rockies start to appear. Well, that's what one of these big dust storms would look like. Some of them were 5,000 feet high and 100 miles wide. And they would call it a duster, a roller, a black blizzard. And so you'd see on the horizon this thing start to approach you. And when it hit, they always knew one was not far because of the static electricity. There was this kinetic energy in the air, and people said you wouldn't shake anyone's hand when one of these dusters was approaching because the static was so strong. And if you were lucky enough to have a car, You dragged a chain so that you could ground that static electricity into the ground. It would short out your car, so you wanted to ground this static. It was so powerful. And people would put towels in their windows, towels under the door. You didn't go to sleep at night without turning all your pots and pans over. I don't know how many people told me that when you woke up in the morning, what you saw on your pillow was the outline of where your head had been. That the dust found a way in these paper-thin houses to penetrate. And it became almost a psychic force. They had these dust lunacy trials in the Texas panhandle where people would just say, I'm going crazy. I can't raise my kids. The wind, the loneliness, the dust is just driving me to lunacy. And so I read a number of the court papers on these things. The court would take someone's family because they said, I just can't raise the kids anymore. So you had this static electricity. You had this, these things became just ferocious. The first big one was in 1934. There was a storm that started in the lower part of the Great Plains, came up through Chicago, dumped about 6 inches of dust as 6 inches of snow would fall on Chicago, moved out to New York City, dumped a load on New York City, and hit ships at sea 100 miles out. And that one was measured at 1,400 miles long in length and 200 miles top to bottom. So the black blizzards were affecting the rest of the country now. So they were, you know, what had been a localized thing was taking on elsewhere. And these storms were becoming this, you know, not beyond a curiosity. What is going on? What has happened to this midsection of our country? What has happened to this great Eden that we settled and brought such a, you know, great bounty from? Well, I'll give you another statistic. There was a storm that everyone called Black Sunday. It happened on April 14th, 1935. And when I interviewed these folks, they remembered Black Sunday as if, you know, we remember what happened in the Nebraska game on Saturday. I think that was a good memory, wasn't it? Didn't they win? Okay, good. Sorry. I think you only have one loss. So that was a reach. But they remembered every detail of Black Sunday, which was a storm that started up in the Dakotas on this beautiful April day. People opened up their windows. They went out and they shook the towels and the sheets of this crappy dust, and they said, it's over. The worst is over. They looked at this bluebird day. They went to church. They went out and played baseball. They went and did the things they did, put on their Sunday clothes, and little did they know this biggest of all storms was dwelling down on them. It was starting in the Dakotas, came through. By the time it got into Denver, people were just freaked, and there were telegrams and phone calls going, it's coming your way, it's coming your way. And it was a complete, one person described it, this is at midday on a sunny day, one person described it as two midnights in a jug. It was pitch black when it hit you. And I don't know how many people told me, the one consistent image I had from people who lived through Black Sunday was you held your hand out and you could not see your fingers. So this thing came, and in the Ken Burns documentary we did, we have some really good pictures of that too, so you can see the thing as it comes through, because the government did a really good job of trying to document this. It comes down, hammers county after county. And again, they're getting a little bit of advance notice, just rolls through, knocks people out. People, if you're not in a shelter when this thing hits, I describe people who are crawling along the streets in about the 2 feet of space above the dust cloud. And everyone runs for shelter in advance of this static. It goes down, it hits the Texas panhandle. And there in Amarillo, Texas, is an itinerant folk singer by the name of Woody Guthrie. And he goes into this tiny little shack, as he describes it, with a single bare light bulb and about a dozen women who were shrieking that it's Armageddon, the end is near, the end is near, it's Armageddon. And Woody, as he describes it, came up with a couple lines that became the song, So Long, It's Good to Know Ya. And he wrote many great Dust Bowl songs, but that one was inspired by what happened on Black Sunday. It goes down to the Gulf of Mexico and it takes a turn. It goes along the Gulf, and then it comes up the coast. And then a few days after April 14th, 1935, this prairie dust is sitting on the White House. It's sitting in the Congress, and there was a guy named Hugh Bennett trying to start the Soil Conservation Service, trying to convince reluctant senators who were tired of hearing about these Okies, tired of hearing about this Dust Bowl, trying to convince them to do something. And finally, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, as Bennett described it in his memoir, the sky outside of our nation's capital goes completely dark, and Bennett points to the window and says, "There, gentlemen, there goes the state of Oklahoma." Now, he convinces them to approve the Soil Conservation Service, which becomes, Roosevelt signs it, it becomes the lasting grassroots legacy of the Great Depression. Grassroots, that's the only thing left over from the Depression in a grassroots sense. Everybody has a soil conservation district now. That's because of what happened after Black Sunday. Now, I've tried to figure out ways of describing what this was. I thought of a line that, you know, they had this Dust Bowl summit in 1936 where they brought all the experts together and Native Americans as well. And one of the things that came out of this was that man himself had become a force of geology. Human beings had, for the first time, actually changed the climate, taken an area the size of the state. People say, you can't change the climate. We did change the climate. We changed an area the size of Pennsylvania. And a simpler way of looking at it was, I found a wonderful fellow named Bam White and his son, Melt White, two names you don't hear much anymore. Melt and Bam sounds like it's out of the Flintstones, actually. Half Anglo, half Apache. And they were cowboys who lived on what was then called what was left of the old XIT Ranch, which is the greatest ranch under fence, they said, in the United States, but Texans exaggerate everything, so you have to take that with a grain of salt. But that ranch had been subdivided, chewed up, given over to farmers, and no longer was a great cattle ranch. And Bam White is looking out over this expanse, this moonscape, this black and white, bleak, despairing, crushed, lifeless land where he used to run his horses over, where he used to graze cattle on this beautiful spring grass, and it's nothing. And he turns to his kid. Now, I got this story from his son. And he says, "Wrong side up." And in those few words, he described what the U.S. Geological Survey couldn't do, what all the scientists couldn't do. That's the story of the Dust Bowl. Wrong side up. They took this turf, and they turned it over. We've always had wind. Everybody knows that. We've always had droughts. You can look at tree rings and look. There were far worse droughts than those that happened in the 1930s. What was different this time was the grass was gone. That was the only element that was taken out. Now, this is also the first time in our history we tried to fix something that we had destroyed. The first time we attempted large-scale restoration. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, I hope a lot of you saw the Roosevelt series on PBS, I thought it was masterful, was not going to let a big part of the United States depopulate and fall to the wind on his watch. He was determined, even after he lost the support of fellow Democrats and his aides, to save what was in the Dust Bowl. And they loved him back. I have a scene at the end of the book where 100,000 people turn out in Amarillo, Texas to greet FDR with the giant American flag, and then it starts to rain. Hasn't rained in 2 years, and the flag sort of bleeds into the streets. But he, shortly after he was elected, Roosevelt went to the plains, and I saw this picture of him. He's in the Dakotas, and some guy, classic-looking Midwestern guy in his bib overalls, they had just gotten rid of Prohibition. That ended two parts, 1932 and 1933. The first part was for beer, the second part was for spirits. Roosevelt had a part of that, and this farmer held up a sign. It said, "Mr. President, you gave us beer, now give us water." And Roosevelt turned to Harold Ickes, his interior secretary and his top aide, and said, "The beer was the easy part." And in fact, just as, you know, wrong side up is the story of the Dust Bowl, beer was the easy part is the story of trying to fix this. They tried a lot of things. Roosevelt sent an army of conservation CCC workers out to the plains. They planted 220 million trees. You can still see some of these. It was a giant shelter belt that was going to go from the Canadian border to the Mexican border. And the idea would be in between this row of trees, you'd be able to farm. That the trees themselves would block the wind. And even after people laughed at him, Roosevelt kept up until they had the 220 million trees. Now, when I started researching this thing, I would approach a town that was just one foot in the grave, and I would see a little spectral row of trees, a handful of them lined up in ways that nature surely couldn't have done. And I'd say, what the hell is that? And it was the remnant of the great Roosevelt project to plant 220 million trees. And you can see it all throughout the Western Prairie. And that was one thing they did. Another thing was they had these people who left. They called them exodusters. And in my part of the country, in the Pacific Northwest, they dammed the Columbia River, the largest river in the West, and created what Roosevelt called the Planned Promised Land. That was its formal name. All this backed up water from the Columbia River would be a place where you could go and start fresh. And that never worked out as it did because that water went to power the energy that made the first atomic bomb and helped to end World War II. So it's amazing how these things turn out, what you think it's going to do and what it ended up doing. They had a summit, as I mentioned, and one of the plans, this is the great historical ironies, there were some natives there, and they turned to these Indians, and they said, could we give it back to you? And these Comanche looked at them and with the expression of, are you crazy? Look what you've done. I mean, you're going to hand this back to us? And then they thought, well, maybe it'll be depopulated, the Indians can restore it. But they knew there was no life. There was nothing they could do there. So he did try to restore this thing, and it's been sort of an okay effort. Part of it worked out okay, the grassland that was replanted. You now have about 16 million acres of what are called national grasslands that are under the United States Forest Service. But for the most part, they never really were able to fix it. They got people to look at the land differently. Hugh Bennett, the founder of the Soil Conservation Service, said, one man cannot stop the soil from blowing, but one man can start it. And so they got people to look at the land as a whole. They got people to farm as a whole. And people always ask me, do you blame the folks who live there? Whose fault was this? Well, it's not up to me to cast blame. I will let the people who lived through that history speak for themselves as they did so eloquently. And they sort of blamed themselves. They used it biblical terms. They put this through a prism of good and evil, that they had gotten greedy, that they had pushed the land too far, that there was an element of hubris involved, and that now they were being punished for pushing the land. And in some sense, they weren't far off. But do I blame them? Heck no. These people never had anything. They were told to settle here. It was an inducement to settle. It was free land. The railroads could have them come out. And so I don't see how you could look at them and say it's your fault. I don't see how you could say them. And also, my other thing I was so struck by, these people, was that, and this is the second part of the Dust Bowl story, outside of the physical part, outside of the environmental story, outside of the commodity story, there's a human resilience story. There's a how much can you take and still stand story. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't sugarcoat this. There were a lot of suicides then. There was a German man whose family I followed, and this woman told me the story of how he had to keep this brave front up, and then one day she found him out behind the barn just bawling his eyes out. And a few days later, he killed himself. And he was upset because his children had burlap clothing, and he couldn't stand to let them go to church in burlap clothing. Well, there were a lot of awful things. I mean, like I said, the birth rate for the first time in our history flattened. People stopped having children. The suicide rate spiked. You had people eating roadkill. You had people at one point taking the aforementioned tumbleweed, Russian thistle, because it was the only thing that was living, and brining it and canning it. They started out feeding it to their horses. They ended up eating it themselves. You had starvation. You had towns sending telegrams to the capital saying, entire town in danger of starving. So you had truly awful stuff going on. You had, there's that scene in the movie Seabiscuit, opening scene where they are giving, the family brings Tobey Maguire to the town square and they have to give him up. I mentioned that. My mind couldn't comprehend that families would ever have, I have two kids, who could ever think of giving up your children? Well, things were so hard, then they did it. But the other side of that are the people who lived through it and came to see a positive life, that came to see it in the range of all things they took in. Now, they were the hardest and the strongest, and I mentioned there was a woman, Hazel, who saw the whole arc of the story. It's why I loved Hazel so much. She was a little 17-year-old girl, she told me, and she got up on the tippy toes of her wagon as they came into the plains, and she saw the grass that they homesteaded. She fell in love with her high school sweetie. She married at 17. She taught school in this one-room sod house. She lost a child a week before Black Sunday to dust pneumonia, which was something I'd never heard of either. It's basically silicosis, but a lot of people died of dust pneumonia. It's when these fine-grained particles, you know, each grain of dust, they said, is about a third of the size of a sentence, of a period at the end of a sentence. And the Red Cross would go into these high schools, and what had been your high school gym where you were staging the Shakespeare play or getting ready for the football game was suddenly a triage hospital. And there was a story a doctor told about a 17-year-old stocky football player kid who started coughing and went in to see the doctor. And he looked inside him and he said, son, you are just filled up with dirt. And this kid died about a week later. So young, healthy people died of dust pneumonia. Hazel lost her child to dust pneumonia. And there's a scene in the book where she has the funeral on the day that Black Sunday hit. And they were out in the road and they had to all dive in their Sunday clothes under this car and wait for this thing to blow over. Well, I got to know the second child of Hazel, named Charles Shaw. He just died a few years ago. And he said, you know, all my life I was claustrophobic and I never figured it out till my mother finally started talking about the Dust Bowl. He said what had happened was after she lost her first child, she would never let the boy sleep without having a cover over his crib because she didn't want any of this. She put a heavy blanket with ventilation, of course, but a blanket over the crib so that dust couldn't get in there. And he said, that's what made me claustrophobic. So Hazel lived, this little girl in the one-room sod schoolhouse. She lived to be 97. I was lucky enough to share the last moments of her life as well. So I heard some amazing, amazing stories of resilience and human endurance that made me realize, and I always tell this when I talk to high school kids, you know, some days you're not going to get cell phone service. Some days the app that tells you where the nearest Taco Bell is not going to appear. But it isn't squat compared to what happened in the Dust Bowl. I say, you can't imagine hardship. And they appreciate that. And I said, if your grandparents are still alive, go with a tape recorder and get them to start talking. Ask them to tell them what it was like in the dirty 30s. Because they, like World War II vets, most of these folks are getting in their really upper years. One more thing about these people. They stopped talking about this story. No one asked them about it. It seemed too far removed from our present day that there could be living human beings in our midst who lived in sod houses, that there could be people who lived on roadkill, that there could be people who plowed up an acre and developed their first homestead and lived on what they could put in the ground. So they stopped talking about it. They thought they would be laughed at. They thought kids and younger people would look at them and think, this is a fantasy, this is a joke. And when I started talking to them, it just poured out. It was like I opened a vein. They wanted to talk about this. Now, they hadn't spoken of it for so long, but it was something they wanted. And so all I was, I was simply someone who, I think of like a baton of a story was handed off to me. I picked up this baton and ran with it like in a relay. I'll close with a story of another woman I really liked. woman named Jeannie Clark, and I opened the book with her because her mother was a Broadway dancer in Broadway, New York City. And New York City then had really awful air, and everyone smoked cigarettes as well, so she was killing herself. She was getting respiratory diseases, and this doctor said, you know what you have to do is you have to go out to Kansas for the air. So she shows up in this little train depot in this little town in Kansas, and it's as if she'd landed on the moon. But this Broadway dancer fell in love with a rancher, and she stayed put, and she produced this little girl, Jeannie Clark, became one of my main characters. Well, about when Jeannie was about 7 years old, 1933, she developed dust pneumonia. And so this family who had come for the air had ended up almost killing their little girl because of the air. And interestingly, you know, the planes used to be, before these dusters, people would go to like Colorado Springs from London to get out of London's terrible air. They would come for the air. It was something that was, it was a positive thing that they would come for. So Jeannie started my journey into these marvelous people's past. And, you know, I'm just a time traveler. I'm just someone who likes to relive these different periods, and all the better if someone's alive. Jeannie was the first person I found. I showed up in this little town in southeast Colorado, and, you know, this was the only functioning business in this town in Lamar County. It was the antique store / museum. So you could look at stuff, and if you wanted to, you could buy it, too. It wasn't a permanent collection. You like that wagon wheel? It's yours. I don't know how many people offered me wagon wheels in what I thought was part of the permanent museum collection. So there was no one there, you know, this tiny little museum, and Jeannie was sitting off in the corner with her oxygen cylinder, 85 years old, and I said, is there anyone around who could tell me what it was like during the Dust Bowl? And she said, son, pull up a chair. And that was the start of my storytelling. And Jeannie and later gathered some other women together, and we sat in a semicircle and heard these marvelous stories. And I mentioned this last night. The first day I heard this, I went back to the hotel, and I almost wept. I was so moved by these stories. And I said, I've got to tell this story. It's going to leave the planet. I've got to tell this story. So I didn't think this book would find an audience. You know, I told my wife, I think I've written a good story. I've told something that hasn't been told, but who's going to want to read a book called The Worst Hard Time? We're a positive people, we Americans. We don't like hardship. And to my great astonishment, you know, this book has sold 1 million copies and found a PBS audience through Ken Burns. And remember how I complained about that one paragraph in the AP history book? It's now at least 2 pages. So they're telling our story. And there's so many things we can learn from this. We can learn about pushing the land too far. There's a climate change parable. But there's a human resilience story, too. There's this story of overcoming everything that can be thrown at you and still coming out the other end somehow. So to end with Jeannie, when this book came out, she said that little kids started to show up on her doorstep and knock on her door and say, are you Jeannie Clark in The Worst Hard Time? She goes, why, yes, I am. Do you mind if I interview you? And these kids wanted to have her tell her story for their school project. Then the county chamber of commerce asked her to be the guest speaker at the lunch and tell her story. And so all these things that she stopped talking about because she was a relic and an icon became coveted things. And she called me up. This is the last thing I ever heard from Jeannie because she died a few months later. She said, Tim, you've made me like a rock star in this town. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Omaha Town Hall Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Timothy Egan, winner of the National Reporting Pulitzer Prize for his work on the series How Race is Lived in America for the New York Times, where he is the Pacific Northwest correspondent. and author of 7 books, including The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America, The Worst Hard Times, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl, for which he won the National Book Award, and his latest book, Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, a biography of iconic photographer and nature advocate Edward Curtis. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday morning, October 22, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Sue Mullen, a member of the Omaha Town Hall Board of Directors, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.